We may have time for a few other questions at the end of the session, but since we are a little pressed for time, I'd like to proceed just to give a brief introduction. Andrew Justice from the University of North Texas, who currently administrates an archive of about 1 million items and is responsible for archiving the other digital collections of the university. And Jonathan Thorne with Safe Sound Archives, who also deeply involved with audio preservation. And they're going to talk about the man on the beat, John Gilliland, and the Pop Chronicles.
Your song, my song, our story. Put them all together and they're history. Your song, my song, my story. Until now my story's been a mystery. None linear, one line of notes. When will this raven stop? Not until we've introduced the Chronicles Pop.
John Gilliland's The Pop Chronicles.
John Sanford Gilliland, Jr. was born on October 15, 1935, in Quanah, Texas, about 220 miles northwest of Dallas-Fort Worth. When he was 12, his grandfather gave him a phonograph and recording console. With this equipment, Gilliland organized the Pleasantville Broadcasting Service with friends and family, writing scripts for original shows and broadcasting so often that his neighbors thought it was a real radio station. In 1954, Gilliland enrolled at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth and worked as a disc jockey at KCUL, then primarily a country and western station. From 9 p.m. to midnight, on a show called The House of Wax, he was known as the man on the beat and played top 40 records, as well as rarely heard rhythm and blues records by black performers. And I have no idea why this is doing this, but I'm just gonna have to deal. He also created a weekly top 20 report called The Rhythm Review, which was based on record sales from Fort Worth area retailers. These self-made postcard publications were designed to provide ideas for telephone requests on his radio show, which was listened to by such Ars luminaries as a young Morris Martin. Gilliland's promotion of R&B prompted invitations to attend local performances and make connections with the artists. This began a career of meeting, and eventually interviewing, an impressive number of musical personalities. Not bad for a 1958 graduate from TCU with a Bachelor of Arts degree in English and an emphasis in creative writing. For the next few years, Gilliland worked at various radio stations in Texas. KLIF in Dallas, KOLJ in Quanah, and in KILT's award-winning news department in Houston. In 1961, he moved to San Diego and worked for 4 years in the news department of KOGO, creating and producing several radio and television documentaries under the nom de plume John Land. And he actually won a Golden Mike Award during this time. In 1965, Gilliland moved to Pasadena and began working at KRLA. After attending the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, he was inspired to create the Pop Chronicles 1950s and 1960s, which first aired in February 1969 and were also syndicated for a time. And here are some examples from each.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a rock and roll show. A bona fide historical rock and roll show.
Doodly-wop, doodly-wop, doodly-wop-wop-wop.
Transcribed, John Gilliland's The Pop Chronicles.
Now, chapter 3. Hail, hail, rock and roll.
1955, and on a Friday night or Saturday afternoon in suburbia USA, the scene was almost always the same. The neighborhood movie house jammed to capacity. A teenage crowd mostly, girls wearing skirts that fell to near ankle length and tight sweaters, boys in khaki or Levi's trousers and sport shirts with the sleeves rolled practically to the armpits. Oh, here and there slumped a surly-looking lad in motorcycle boots and black leather jacket, doing the Brando or James Dean thing. Then, as the house lights started to go down, and the bland intermission music began to fade away, the stale air of the theater seemed charged with a kind of electricity, the electricity of expectation. There was a noticeable and dramatic silence. You thought it lasted 5 minutes at least, but it was only a split second. And then...
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around 10 o'clock tonight. But it's flat and soft. Join me home. We'll have some fun. When the band starts, we're going to rock.
This is the sound of Motown.
Now, the Soul Reformation, Phase 4.
A 13-year-old Detroit lad named William Smokey Robinson. 1953 is the year you get together with some chums, Bobby Rogers, Ronnie White, and Pete Moore, and form a singing group, an R&B style group, like the kind that's just starting to make big commercial noise nationally. Oh, the name that you and the guys pick for yourselves is marvelously prophetic. The Miracles.
When we first started to sing, it was a real group craze. In the ghetto area, I would say, where we came from. Well, the first group that I saw that was really inspirational to me was Billy Ward and the Dominoes. And this was when they had Clyde McFadden with them.
Living and working in the Los Angeles area allowed Gilliland to record interviews with many artists. And these interviews provided significant content for the 55 hours that comprised these shows. Conducted between 1955 and 1977, 180 raw source interviews are included in his collection. Here's a sampling.
Okay. When I first started playing, I grew up going to church every Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. My mother was a Sunday school teacher, and first of all, I was an adopted child, and my mother, the only mother I know anything about, she was a Sunday school teacher, and my real mother is still living. And so they decided to buy me a guitar for Christmas.
By playing your songs, I mean, what it's all about. But now, suppose there's somebody around who's never heard blues, somebody from, like Mars or something. Now, how would you explain to him, he wouldn't have your guitar and he couldn't sing, how would you tell him what the blues was all about? Is that a fair question? Could you kind of help me and see what you, not just tell us, don't let him.
Well, sir, if you read it, I want to hear the truth.
Yeah, I want it.
The blues
if the thing is just like a fella getting himself shook up with an old lady, I wasn't ever and feel like he wanted my stiff drink of liquor.
It's our favorite part of the story.
Chuck Berry wanted to do his own producing, his own arranging, his own writing, and it cannot be done. I think at this point he's realizing that.
Do you think, Leonard, that you don't think then that his color had anything to do with the fact that he did not achieve the fame that an Elvis Presley received?
I don't think the color did it. It was the trend of the market and the buying power, which there is no differential at this time, at that time it did exist. We're going back 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and that kept him from becoming an Elvis Presley, and Chuck Berry was shaking his knees before I ever heard of an Elvis Presley.
Too long. I don't really know how it started. It didn't sort of, it was a very strange involvement. And I don't really know what the end was. You know, it's just a sort of thing that was, which is what we were going through at the time. And we had a lot of problems, and they just all came out on the album. But had problems on the album, problems and everything. So we just kind of made this album, which sounds like a sort of elucidation of a problem, but I don't think the next album will be a sort of going on top of that. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it will be another layer of icing on top of that at all, and because that just reflected what we felt during that period, you know. And I think Brian Jones on the phone. Bye. I think the next one will be very different.
You can probably tell, but by the way, this interview took place at Jagger's flat in England. Gilliland flew over there to do this interview. And the interview was followed by an impromptu, probably drug-addled jam session upstairs in the recording studio that he had. And Gilliland taped that too. There are several other tapes like this in the collection where performances follow interviews. Some notable examples we have are B.B. King and Eric Clapton.
That burst of rock and roll, when it first came out, when I was in junior high school, was about people like Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard, that time. That's the only music that's ever really turned me on.
I think the initial question that I have to ask is, you've done so many different things in so many different areas, country and western, blues, jazz, all of these fields. It certainly indicates a magnificent, wide-ranging interest in music of all kinds. Have you always had that wide an interest like to so many different things?
I believe so, because even when I was a youngster, you know, 8, 9 years old, I used to listen to the Grand Ole Opry then, you know, when I was quite young. And of course, I liked rhythm and blues at that time, and I loved what they called swing then. You know, it used to be with, you know, Benny Goodman's and Otis Shaw's and Count Basses and Duke Ellington's, and you know. And then I also, I was crazy about boogie woogie back in those days, you know. It used to be people like Meat Lux Lewis and Pete Johnson and Abbott Ammons, you know. These were great boogie woogie players to me. And so all these are different varieties of music. And then when I got a little old, I knew a little more about music, I got to also appreciate classical music.
You also like Teddy Wilson, I understand.
Yeah, well,
Well, now let me start out, Richard, by asking you, you know, the first time I heard your most distinctive style I think I've ever heard in my life, how in the world did you ever develop a style like that, beginning with Tutti Frutti?
Well, John, you know, I'm from Macon, Georgia, and I was washing dishes at the Greyhound bus station. That was my job from 7 to 7, 12 hours a day. And I used to go home and I played piano for a Holiness Church. It was the Church of the Living God at the time. And their music is very rhythmic. So I used to go home and sit down. So I made up Tutti Frutti when I was 14 years old. So I've been singing it around school. And so everybody said, oh, it's nothing. You know how it is. You're just a regular boy around there. So I heard Lloyd Price sing Lordy Miss Claudy. So I asked him about the record company he was with. He said, won't you make a tape?
To shed further light on this last interview, we'd like to show you part of a video interview done with Gilliland by Leon Morris in 1991.
Now, you told me earlier about interviewing a lot of these performers, particularly Little Richard.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that interview?
Well, the actual interview was certainly X-rated. I couldn't tell it all. Suffice it to say, it was done in his motel room on La Cienega in Los Angeles, and there was a young woman in bed throughout the course of the interview, except when she got up to answer the door for the chicken delight man, or his manager, or his arranger. There were a lot of people in this room that kept coming and going. And every time she got up, I discovered she had no clothes on. And she would sort of sidle as though I'm standing over the entrance. Sidle over the door a little bit, and then sidle back. The first time I met Richard was in my work. That was the night this creature with the tall hair and the silver suit and shoes appeared, and you could smell the perfume across the room. It was a big, we're talking big room here. And of course he got it. He had just had a couple of hits, the first Tutti Frutti and then Long Tall Sally, and Slip and Slide, I think, was on the back of that one, I believe. Slip and Slide, Long Tall Sally, I believe. And, he took us all back, us meaning the disc jockeys, myself and Jimmy Clemens, Jerry Thomas and Freddie James and the Gruettes and the Entourage. And I had a copy of Tutti Frutti for him to sign, which he did. And then he opened up this valise stuffed with money and proceeded to pull out 20s and hand each of us an autographed $20 bill and just a little expression of my appreciation.
While at KRLA, Gilliland worked on Lou Erwin's nationally acclaimed show, The Credibility Gap, which led to a comedy record titled Lou Erwin and The Credibility Gap, an album of political pornography, which was released in 1968 on the Blue Thumb label. Incidentally, these original members of The Credibility Gap were succeeded by Harry Scherer, David Lander, and Michael McKeon. So it may be possible that Gilliland was an inspiration not only for the characters Lenny and Squiggy, but also Spinal Tap. In 71, Gilliland moved to San Francisco and joined KSFO, appearing on the 7 p.m. to midnight slot. It was during this time that he created the 24-hour blockbuster, The Pop Chronicles 1940s, which first aired on November 3rd, 1972.
Dooley Wilson, and a 1931 song that became a hit in 43, thanks to exposure in Warner's Casablanca, voted Best Picture of the Year. Because of the musician strike, the record companies had to dig into their archives and come up with some 30-ish renditions of this revival tune, Jacques Renard's For Decca Brunswick, and Rudy Valley's on Victor.
It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die.
At KSFO, Gilliland was known for his diverse programming, which in addition to the Pop Chronicles included old radio shows, comedy tapes, and straight-ahead music programs. In 1978, he moved back to Texas, partly to fulfill a lifelong dream of writing a novel about radio, and partly to take care of his mother. In 1994, a condensed version of the Pop Chronicles 1940s was published on four cassette tapes by Mind's Eye. approximately 6 hours of content with an emphasis on swing music. While in Texas, Gilliland also completed two manuscripts, one titled Station Break, but was not able to find a publisher for either. He spent the rest of his retirement doing video production and voiceover work. John Gilliland died on July 27, 1998, in his birthplace of Quanah, Texas. Gilliland's sister, Martha Mullen, donated more than 250 reel-to-reel, DAT, and cassette tapes, including the Raw Source interviews, from his personal collection to the University of North Texas Music Library in 2003. I will now turn this presentation over to Jonathan, who will discuss the technical aspects of his work with this collection.
Thank you. Upon receiving the collection, we conducted an initial assessment and inspection of the tapes. We found that we basically had over 200 reels of Scotch 111 quarter-inch open reel analog tape, and then some DAT and cassette safety copies. No mold or vinegar syndrome was found in the inspection on any of the tapes, and the tapes seemed to be in overall good condition. The primary concerns we did encounter, however, on inspection were bad tape packs. Many had been stored for years with uneven, stepped, and loose packs. Then upon analog playback, tapes were Scotch 111, 1.5 mil acetate base. We received them on 10-inch, 7-inch, and 5-inch reels, and were full-track mono and half-track dual mono. And they're fairly mixed up. The broadcasts were recorded at 15 IPS and stored tails out as we received them, and the interviews range from 3¾ to 15 IPS. The interviews were originally recorded using a variety of smaller portable tape recorders and microphones, which we do not have very much information about those. The broadcasts seem to have been produced and recorded on somewhat higher end tape recorders in a fairly consistent fashion. We have, from one picture, we know seems to be a Scully 280 model tape machine here, so we know that was used. The tapes were played back in our preservation studio at the University of North Texas Music Library on Atari MTR-10 tape machines. Each tape transfer was fully monitored. Full-track and half-track machines were used depending on the tape's original head-track configurations. An Atari MX5050 and Revox B77 were also employed for some of the slower tape speed transfers. The MTR-10s only range from 7.5 to 30 IPS. The machines were all aligned and calibrated before the transfer process began. Azimuth was adjusted per tape, calibrated to NAB equalization at 180 nanowebers per meter. The digitization process: the tapes were transferred at 16-bit, 441 kilohertz to compact disc. Mitsui Advanced Media Gold CDRs were chosen as the destination format. The broadcast tapes were PQ'd or tracked at the leader divisions on the original. These were leadered pauses on the originals meant for commercial breaks. The raw interviews were tracked at 5-minute intervals and any other significant points for just easier navigation. No editing was necessary. In our eyes, the intent of digitizing the tapes was both for preservation and access. However, the preservation aspect took precedence over access in the digitization strategy. Therefore, no DSP or noise reduction was employed, but we didn't really need to do any of that anyway. The recordings were in fine listening condition, as you can hear. A simple tray card was used for documentation and navigation of the program material, and each tape and corresponding digital copy is given a unique identifier. A few of the limitations we had during the transfer process, although my primary concern was the analog playback, which seems to be much more important in my eyes, we were unable to digitize it higher bit depths and sample rates than that of CD quality, basically due to equipment limitations we had at the time, and also the CD format is preferred format for patron access at the audio center there. Also at the time, there wasn't really a partnership with IT and land department for the management, long-term storage, and migration of digital files, which Andrew will talk a little more about that in a few moments, which those are paramount concerns. And since there was nowhere for any type of digital files to go, we did what we could, use CDs. Storage and current preservation strategy is fairly simple. All original tapes and documentation, which we also have all of his research files, are being retained and housed in permanent storage. There are currently two sets of the CDs, a preservation master set and an access copy set, that are both geographically separated and in climate controlled storage. And thank you very much. I'm going to turn it back over to Andrew to discuss future plans and strategies for the collection.
In addition to the shows and the interviews, we also got his Gilliland's collection of 45s and 33s, a lot of which are autographed. So a couple of things that we have to think about is not only doing the preservation, but also allowing some sort of access to these things. As far as the records go, especially the ones that are autographed, we will be cataloging those, but those are not going to circulate, unlike the 750,000 other LPs that we have. I was going to show you the website, because that's, in my mind, where the actual future of the collection is kind of the most exciting. Hopefully I still have a wireless connection. We have the biography and collection overview and some photos up. Here we have the indexes to the interviews and to the shows. These were all done by Jonathan originally in HTML format, and then we moved to this new open source product called Plone for the library's websites. It's essentially a database. But as you can see, you can search by name, and everything, all the text on these pages comes up in a Google search, although it's way, way down in the results right now. You can see that you got name, identifiers, where the interview took place, the location of it, what shows the interviews appear on, and then a reference number, which we have a separate database which corresponds our reference numbers with for the tapes with our CDs, so they can be easily found. For the shows, we have them in this kind of a format where you can see the title of the show and how the reels are split up and the path that the show takes. And this is actually, in my mind, where the future of the collection lies. What I would like to do is get these things online and stream them, because they were written, arranged, and produced by John Gilliland. So getting his sister's permission would be more than half the battle. As far as getting radio stations permissions, as Jonathan has told me, KRLA has gone up and down as far as going defunct several times. It's something that I think having this content available online for people to listen to, in the background at work or whatever, would be a very good thing. As far as streaming the source interviews, since the content is a little more delicate, I'm a little more hesitant to do that. But as far as having them searchable online and then accessible if you come into the library, we feel that that's a sort of a balanced way to approach accessing that part of the special collection. Gilliland's sister still has posters and more records and more sort of memorabilia from his career. I think she also has the manuscripts for the novels, which that's kind of an exciting prospect as far as being able to gain access to those. Just because we're trying to communicate, the guy did such a great job of not only researching the history, but also going out and doing ethnomusicological type work, of field work, of recording these artists and getting their opinions and getting impromptu performances. And John told me today, there's even a tape for the 60s in the psychedelic era where they recorded Gilliland on acid. And it's there, and he says it's really kind of weird.
It's a fun job.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what we're thinking about for the future of this collection. We have, if you know anything about our collections, we have way too much stuff. And we get lots of requests, especially for our Willis Conover collection and the Voice of America recordings. And we do occasionally get requests for people asking to find these things because they're not readily available. And I'm always pushing them off and saying, do web searches, find independent collectors, go on eBay. we're, as far as we know, we are one of the only places that has the complete run of the Pop Chronicles series. And so to sort of end up, finish it, wrap up this presentation, we wanted to give you an ending tribute that the guys at KSFO did for Gilliland right as he was moving back to Texas.
Thank you. Where's Buffalo Bob? All right. I've got to get serious now because I am. And at a time like this, it's both fitting and proper. Well, perhaps not so proper, but I hate goodbyes. And I knew this being John Gilliland's last night on KSFO, I couldn't let it go by without paying my respects.
Now we present a very minor tribute to a true radio star, John Gilliland. John has had a very varied broadcasting career, rubbing elbows with the great and near great. Once a top union boss was scheduled to appear on John's show. However...
Where is he? You mean he disappeared? Well, who's next?
A famous singer sang to it. And listeners even wrote in to let John know their feelings about his music.
You ought to put that to music. That's the same song I've been hearing for the last week.
One of the actors on Mystery Theater made no bones concerning his feelings about J.G.
Did I ever tell you how much I love you?
Asked about current programming, John replied,
Grandpa says 99% peanuts.
But he loves KSFO. How many people sing to a radio station?
KSFO in San Francisco.
And he also commented about a high company official rather briefly.
Wonderful wino.
J.G., always quick with the wit, could be counted on for lightning replies during interviews.
Your place or mine, my dear.
Or?
Take a welder home to lunch with you.
Or? Although it's only a one-night stand. His taste, always obvious. Pauline Hale of the New York Times, after interviewing J.G., was amazed by the fire and fury of the man and his show. She said,
the fury is so strong, no Hitchcock thriller was ever so intense, went so far, or had so many classic sequences.
Yes, John is still, after all these years. And that's our mini tribute to John, what's his name again?
Now, if Mr. Land were here, what he'd probably say is,
Geneva, I can't tell you how disappointed I am in your boy blundering tonight.
Hear the sound of the city, the songs that are heard in San Francisco.
Questions about the collections or want to link to the website, we have these nice little brochures here. Thanks very much.
We are officially out of time, but if anyone has a question and they're willing to answer it, let's do it. Yes?
Somebody made a point about how at the time, the institution, the facilities were a little less advanced than they are now. You know, did the best we could with what it had, but the institution has since moved on and is now working in, shall we say, a somewhat more sophisticated fashion. And I'm wondering what the lessons of making the most of what you had informed what you do now, and what in what ways with your newer systems you're looking to manage the formats that you created in an earlier day?
Well, to begin with, our tech situation is only slightly more advanced since this happened. University red tape being what it is, and the glacial rate of being able to get funding and support.
But you're a huge institution with tons of money.
No, we're not.
That's in Austin.
It took 6 months for me to put in a request for an iMac, an AD converter, which we never had. He used his own equipment on this and took it home, and the software to do the editing. It took 6 months between the time that I put in the request and when we actually heard that the request got approved. And we have everything but the iMac right now. So the situation isn't much better, but as far as lessons learned, I mean, to be really brutally honest, I'm still really new at this, and I rely on him and the guy who succeeded him, another graduate assistant, to basically give me their opinions as far as what can be done with these files. Like he said, the quality of the regional radio shows really, it's pretty good. It doesn't leave a lot to be desired. And as far as putting those online and putting them in a streaming format, which with the compression you're going to lose some quality anyway, I'd like to think that it sort of recreates the original experience of listening to the radio show. So thinking, you know, in a long-term format like that, I really, because I'm staring at a mountain of collections and a lot that I could do, what I have to do is basically take it one step at a time and focus on one project at a time and do the best that we can with the equipment that we have in order, because in my mind, the goal is providing access for the patrons. The preservation is great, but since I deal with patrons on a daily basis, I have a real strong desire to give them what they want within reason.
Do you have any other questions? You can grab these guys sometime during the coffee break. Thank you all for coming.